You're listening to Thoughtcast. I'm Jenny Atiyya. In 1882, Friedrich Nietzsche wrote famously, "God is dead," but perhaps he was a bit short-sighted, for today it's existentialism that's on the wane, while God has made rather a dramatic comeback. In this era of megachurches, madrasas, and meditation retreats, are we witnessing the birth of a new spirituality in a post-postmodern world? Or is this just a blip, a hiccup, a nostalgic detour? How profound is this new religiosity, and how powerful is it? How persuasive? To answer these questions, I've turned to the eminent theologian, Harvey Cox. Harvey, welcome to Thoughtcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what's causing all of this, Harvey? Where is this burst of religiousness coming from?
Well, I think probably what's at the root of it is the disenchantment and disappointment that many people have experienced with what I would call the promise of modernity. Perhaps the overpromise that science and technology and education and literacy were all going to move us along toward a brave new world. And this did not happen. 50 years ago, many people were counting on that sort of inevitable progress theory of history, and also suggesting that as we progressed, perhaps religion would become more marginal or of diminishing significance. And certainly religion did not become of diminishing significance, but all the promises and hopes and expectations, some of them false expectations, turned out not to have happened. And so there's a lot of disappointment, frustration, and with all of the solutions that have been offered, nationalism, capitalism, communism, and so people are reaching for something which has been there for a long time, a sense of community, a sense of connection with the past, some way of envisioning a future that's better. And these ideas are encapsulated in the religious traditions. And I think that's why they're now coming back, even though they were thought to be on the way down not too long ago.
But you write that this resurgence isn't always welcome. Why not?
Well, if you've studied religion as long as I have, and it's quite a long time now, you know that when there's a religious renaissance, as we're living through now, it's good news and it's bad news. It's unexpected, at least most people did not expect Islam to sort of come alive in this way in this late 20th, early 21st century, but there it is. And we're dealing with it in all kinds of different levels and expressions. Religion is a very, very potent force, perhaps the most potent force in human life. So it can produce very nasty figures and very noble figures. If you think of really the most admirable people, at least in my repertory of the 20th century, are people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, both of whom operated with religious motivations. But if you look at the range of history, there are some inquisitors and some organizers of crusades and jihads, and it's a double-edged sword. So naturally, it isn't welcome. I don't even welcome. I am not one of those who welcomes in an unqualified way the return of religion. I think one has to be very, very selective about what one welcomes.
Speaking of which, in your book, When Jesus Came to Harvard, you mention the Muslim Renaissance, which sounds like a pretty positive spin on what's going on with Islam today.
Well, yeah, I mean, calling it a renaissance is a kind of a positive way. It's a revival. It's a revolutionary movement. In some instances, it's a very conservative movement. People want to conserve the way they have been living for years and years, centuries, against the incursions of what they see to be a cheapening Western culture. It's unexpected, at least most people did not expect Islam to sort of come alive in this way in this late 20th, early 21st century, but there it is. And we're dealing with it in all kinds of different levels and expressions.
Harvey Cox, you teach religion at the Harvard Divinity School. You analyze the subject critically, but you're also a believer, am I right?
Yes. If you want to use the word believer, I have problems with the word believer. Call me a man of faith.
What do you have faith in, Harvey?
Well, first of all, in God. I would say, and in the particular understanding of God that I have acquired through the life and teachings of Jesus, as they've come down to us through the Christian church, Christian tradition, and have suffered a lot of lacerations and dislocations and distortions on the way, but still, there it is. But I would like to make this distinction between faith, which is confidence, fides. It has to do with loyalty, it has to do with trust, whereas I am very critical of those forms of Christianity which have reduced it to belief, that is, assenting to the truth of a proposition, a creed, a statement about God or about Jesus or about anything else, which makes it a kind of a cognitive activity. It puts it in the head rather than the heart, let's put it that way.
What about the religious right? Their support helped hand Bush the presidency, but that was then. What about now?
Oh, I think it's on the way down. I think they've had their moment in this, their day in the sun, and they're fighting among themselves. They're not really able to deliver the kind of votes to the polls that they said they did. Their potency as a political force is on the decline. The other thing that's happening is that the younger people within the evangelical community, maybe as distinguished from the religious right, are interested in a wider range of subjects. They're interested in environmental issues, in helping people with AIDS, enormously interested in poverty.
This sounds like a progressive platform.
Yeah, it's becoming a progressive platform, and it's an evangelically supported progressive political outlook, which is absolutely against the agenda of the religious right.
This religious left that you're referring to, how influential is it?
I think it's strong and it's growing, and it's mainly growing among younger people within the evangelical community and young adults. So I think that the future is theirs. And I think these old guys, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell is gone now, may he rest in peace. The old warriors of the religious right are really now pretty much in retreat. So I think we're seeing the rise of a new generation of leadership in the whole evangelical movement, and the kind of last hurrah, if you will, of these old religious right leaders.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm speaking with the Harvard theologian and author Harvey Cox. What's so interesting and kind of ironic here is that your first book, The Secular City, which came out in 1965, really was describing the increasing secularization of society, which is the opposite of what's going on right now. So how did we get from there to here?
First of all, I perhaps was stating it too strongly. I don't think religion ever went away, as I was saying to you. I think it was always around, just not as noticeable, perhaps. Was not part of the public discourse as much. Now, let me point out one thing, however, which is often mistaken about Secular City, which I wrote a number of years ago, I must say. And a lot of people don't know this, and why should they? The original title was God in the Secular City, because my thesis in the book is that God is not just present in the religious sector of life, but in all of life. Economics, family life, business, politics, nature. I was saying God is present in the secular city to be found, responded to. However, the publisher said, look, God in the secular city, it's kind of awkward. Let's just call it the secular city, which is what it was called.
Well, the thesis is clearly that God is present, but we don't need or really care about the trappings.
Right.
That they've become somewhat harmless or irrelevant. And I get the feeling that you're pretty comfortable with that description, with the world where the rituals of religion, the institutions behind it are less important.
Well, yes, I am. And I think this is not a particularly novel idea, that the important thing about religion has to do with its spiritual and moral core, with the fact that we turn to religion for meaning, for values, and we do it in a wide variety of different ways, different rituals, different doctrines, different polities. And I'm not saying they're insignificant, but we shouldn't mistake the reality for the packaging. That's what I'm saying here.
If I were to try and describe what I think your belief is to go back to that dangerous word, belief, I'd say it's, don't listen to the church, listen to Jesus. Go out and help your fellow man, don't count rosary beads.
Well, if you have to choose between Jesus and the church, I know which choice I would make. And I think that Jesus would be as surprised as anyone else to come back and see what we have done in his name and at the church. Somebody once wrote that when Jesus lived, what he tried to do was to establish the kingdom of God. And what happened was the church, which is different from the kingdom of God, a lot different. So I think that there's always tension between Jesus and the church. But the church is also, the church is the people who have tried in some way to continue what he was doing. And some people have done it better than others. And some people have really messed it up badly, and some have distorted it. It's a mixed bag. But the choice there is pretty easy. As far as rosary beads, I have never been particularly attached to rosary beads, but there are people who are and who find in them some spiritual significance. I'm certainly not going to snatch them away from them. I'm not in the business of doing that. I'm just hoping that and suggesting that we should not ever confuse the means with the end, or not the finger that points to the moon with the moon, as the Zen saying has it. Symbols point to something beyond themselves. We need them to be pointed to what we are looking for, but we shouldn't be stuck on the symbol.
And this thinking somewhat represents your political and activist views, doesn't it? Your vision of the secular city is one where people go out and help others, regardless of whether the church tells them to or not.
Right. That's true.
And if I understand you correctly, you're saying it's easy for people to escape into the trappings of religion.
Yeah.
They can go inward and not help anybody at all and not contribute to the kingdom of God in any way.
Yes, that's possible to do. Not only go inward individually, but they can go into a kind of a ecclesial enclave, you might say, and sort of the interior of church life, which doesn't have much to do with the alleviating and the suffering of the world or trying to fashion structures that are more just and equitable bring people in around the table who've been excluded and marginated.
How does your vision of what the secular city was and can and perhaps should be compare with what's going on right now? If I can go back to when Jesus came to Harvard, you write about, quote, the feeble complacency and the superficial religiousness that is engulfing us today.
See, not only is religion or religious revival both bane and blessing, but there's an awful lot of religion that's just plain trivial and boring and distracting. And so I think atheists are sort of interesting people. I'm kind of secretly glad we have these new sort of atheist books coming out. At least there's a certain kind of vitality and teeth in it, I'd far rather have a good conversation with an atheist than with a kind of a limp, trivializing religious person.
You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah, and I'm speaking with Harvey Cox, the Harvard theologian and best-selling author of The Secular City. Harvey, you've written that when you were growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania, your parents weren't churchgoers. They were what you call Christmas and Easter Christians. But you were a churchgoer. What did your parents make of your religiousness?
They were tolerant of it. They thought, you know, just don't take it to excess. It's all right. Just go easy with it. And then they got, I think, a little embarrassed when I got quite serious and wanted to study theology, and not quite embarrassed, but it was a mixture of pride that I was going to do something significant in my life when I might have been just a wastrel, but also kind of wishing maybe I'd done something more profitable, maybe go into being an accountant, something that was more economically productive, because they thought it was ministers, quite rightly, as people who didn't earn very much money. But they sort of came along. And then after I actually started going to divinity school, I came home one time, and lo and behold, my father, for the first time in memory, actually showed up in the church, actually started going to church, and did until he died.
I'd like you to read a section from When Jesus Came to Harvard, Harvey. You write about when you were a boy and you would get up while it was still dark and tiptoe out of the house to attend the Easter sunrise service. You were going all by yourself, and it describes how you would come back to the house after the service.
Okay. Oh, yeah, here it is. Yes. By the time I got back home, where my parents, who were not churchgoers, were just coming down to breakfast in their bathrobes, I felt buoyant and a little self-righteous. I do not remember giving much thought, one way or another, to whether the biblical text quoted at the start of the service, this is, of course, the resurrection narrative, which I just heard, read, or the sermon that had just been preached. I don't remember wondering about whether they were true. It just never entered my mind. That began to change when I became a teenager. And as with all teenagers, people I knew began dying. Thoughts of my own mortality often upset me. My awareness of death was no doubt deepened when I began to work part-time with my Uncle Frank, who was the town's only undertaker, or mortician, as he preferred to be called. I went out with his crew to pick up the bodies of the people who had just died and bring them to his morgue. I watched him embalm some of them on a white table with a formaldehyde solution. I helped carry caskets to the cemetery. Some of the people he buried were old, some young. Some were stout, some thin. But to me, they all had one thing in common. They all looked very dead. Yet at the graveside, whatever minister was in charge always talked about the resurrection of the dead. And they were not just talking about Jesus. They were talking about everyone, what is known as, quote, the general resurrection. I began to wonder. It was not long before I began to ask myself the question I had not asked as a youngster. Was what the Bible said and what the songs and ministers proclaimed really true? And if there was eventually going to be a general resurrection, what was happening to all those dead people in the meantime? Now and then, when a person died, someone in the church would say they were already in heaven, or they had gone to be with God. But that did not seem consistent with a general resurrection sometime in the distant future. Then, when I began to meet people who said there was no such thing as a life after death, that when you were dead, and that's that, the mystery deepened. Once in a while, I would ask someone about what seemed to me a nest of contradictions, but I never got a satisfying answer. Eventually, I just stopped asking.
Did you ever get an answer to that question?
Still asking. I started asking again after I stopped asking.
Harvey Cox, thank you very much for speaking with ThoughtCast.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the eminent Harvard theologian Harvey Cox on ThoughtCast. If you'd like to leave a comment, please go to our website at thoughtcast.org and search for Harvey Cox. Coming up, the British philosopher Simon Blackburn on the practical uses of philosophy. Stay tuned. You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah. Of what use is philosophy? Does it belong in our daily lives? Can it aid in the big decisions of our day, to go to war, to raise taxes or lower them, to assure everyone health care, education, even happiness? Can it help us decide which job to take, which man to date? Is it a plaything of academics who like to puzzle over the concepts of truth, beauty, and virtue? Or can it help us become better people? To answer these questions, I've turned to Simon Blackburn, a professor of philosophy at the University of Cambridge in England. He's the author of Truth, A Guide, Think, and Being Good, books he wrote not for the expert, but for the layman. Simon Blackburn, welcome to ThoughtCast. Do we really need more philosophy in our lives?
Well, need is a strong word. I think our lives benefit from it. I think that reflection is not the privilege of the educated elite. I think we all reflect. We may do it sort of in a fairly confused way. We may do it without very much coming out of it. But I think it's a process we can't avoid. We're self-conscious animals, reflective animals, and my books are there to help that process along. They're not designed to tell you any answers. They're designed to help you work out the answers for yourself.
So it seems, Simon, you're trying to release philosophy from the confines, the restraints of the academy. But what can it do for us? Can it stop wars?
Well, I certainly think it can help. I mean, the ancient Greeks, who we always look back to, of course, in philosophy, believed that philosophy was there to enable you to live the good life. And although that ambition might be slightly difficult to achieve, I think it can help, and therefore it can help you substitute cooperation for competition, substitute talk for aggression, and it could, in principle, help you stop wars, I think. For example, the knee-jerk reaction to go all out for a war on terror after 9/11 may not have been the most intelligent response to Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. There may have been other much more intelligent responses, such as trying to understand the motivations that lead to that kind of terrorism and alter the world so that they no longer get a purchase or get a popular purchase across the Islamic world. Now, I'm not saying I know how to do that or even that it was possible, but it was certainly an avenue worth exploring, and I think it's the avenue that philosophy would have taken us down, rather than the knee-jerk reaction of revenge or going to war.
Simon, you've chosen to express these ideas in your, quote, more popular books of philosophy, but you've also written more serious works, notably Spreading the Word, Essays on Quasi-Realism, and Ruling Passions, A Theory of Practical Reasoning. So whose side are you on, the closed circle of academics or the rest of us?
I don't make a sharp distinction, Jenny. I don't like thinking of my more popular books as popularizations. That, of course, is a dirty word in academe, and I'm sure there are people out there who say, oh, Blackburn's sold out, he's a mere popularizer, and so on. I resist that, and the image I like to use is I think of myself as bringing people to philosophy. I don't think of myself as diluting philosophy for people. I think there's as much... In a way, there's as much hard philosophy in a little book like Think or Being Good as there is in Spreading the Word.
Simon, we live, or at least we think we live, in a democracy.
Right.
But of course, Plato preferred the idea of the philosopher king.
Yes.
A wise man capable of rising above his own interests to rule on behalf of the people. And I once asked Anthony Appiah, a philosopher at Princeton, about this concept. And he thinks that some philosophies are dangerous, and if you give a philosopher the power to act in the real world, bad things can happen. He mentioned Pol Pot, for example.
Yeah, sure. No, I think that's right. I mean, ideas are dangerous. Basically, people, they organize themselves around ideas. The idea of who gets what, of whether you should be armed or not, whether these immigrants should be fed or not, how you distribute medical resources, how you tax people, what does the state deserve from people in return for what it gives them, and so on. All those are ideas. And if you disagree about those ideas, it may become very dangerous. Or if you've got the wrong ideas, it may become catastrophic.
And in many ways, I do think the question is valid about philosophy. In what way can it be appropriated, for good or for ill?
Right. Well, that's a very good question, Jenny. I dread to think, but it's probably true that, you know, given the mixed and spotty creature that we are, that reflection has as good a chance of going wrong, and when it goes wrong, things go wrong with it, as anything else. You only have to think of Marxism, for example, which is a philosopher's take on society, a very intelligent take on society, but unfortunately dead wrong, and look at what it cost us. Nazism, everybody's favorite example of the world gone wrong, is the offshoot of German Romanticism. You couldn't have had Hitler without the Romantic movement and the nostalgia for a lost past, and therefore the looking for a scapegoat for victims who were responsible for our decline and fall. All those ideas are implicit in German Romanticism. And you know, and it in its beginning, that must have seemed the most harmless set of reflections and set of attitudes to life, almost ascetic, just the poet in the wilderness and the nature and beautiful trees and so on. But it just requires a tincture of things going wrong and you get all hell breaking loose, literally. So I don't think anyone should make an apology for spending a life bothered about ideas. I think they're the most dangerous things we have, more dangerous than guns, because the ideas determine who's got the guns.
Simon, you lived in the U.S. for a decade in the 1990s when you taught philosophy at the University of North Carolina, so obviously you know us pretty well. How would you rate the philosophical health of the climate here in the U.S.?
Well, if we were talking simply about the state of philosophy in your universities, it's very, very good. If it's a question of the state of mind of everybody else, or at least of the demos, the people, then I worry about it much more. I think America, and for that matter, England, unfortunately, are aggressive countries. They're countries in which unbridled aggression is not uncommon. I think it's thought that an American child watches something like 18,000 murders on TV before they're grown up.
But no sex.
But no sex. So that's three murders a day, I suppose, is the calculation. But no sex. And I know a lot of parents, concerned parents, sensible parents, worry about that. And I'd worry about it.
The lack of sex.
Especially the lack of sex, yes. Well, I wrote a book on lust, so I've got to stick up for that.
In your book, Lust, written for a series on the seven deadly sins, published by Oxford University Press and the New York Public Library, you shoot down the ages-old belief that while men are by nature promiscuous, women are naturally modest and monogamous.
That's right. That's a patriarchal story in which I don't believe. There is a motive, especially for men, to guard the chastity of their women. I think that's visible in societies almost worldwide. As Hume remarks, it's because of the trivial anatomical difference that women always know who their own children are and men don't.
Not so trivial.
Not so trivial, no. Well, of course, I ought to say that although the book Lust was enjoying itself in that chapter, I didn't argue for a radical liberation movement. It says, therefore, as a result of all this, women shouldn't be educated in that way. I think that's a different matter because, of course, the fact that they are educated that way may, you know, that may too have evolved over centuries as the best way of the sexes cooperating. It may have needed that to stop men being even worse than they are in some way or another. So,
to me, if I may say, that sounds perhaps somewhat self-serving.
Well, I have to be careful, don't I? Yes.
Well, Simon, thank you for your thoughts, and thank you for being a guest on ThoughtCast.
My pleasure, Jenny. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You've been listening to the Cambridge philosopher Simon Blackburn on ThoughtCast. We welcome your thoughts on truth, philosophy, lust, virtue. Just go to the site and search for Simon Blackburn. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.